Soccer Federation president, Luis Rubiales, kissed the soccer player, Jenny Hermoso, on the lips, on the podium, and are going to move on to a new and probably equally a shocking topic. In the next half hour of conversations. So what have you got for us, Ava?
Yeah, so I brought today the topic of medical gaslighting. I thought I'd just start off by defining that because I'm not sure if it's a term that's, you know, known to everyone. So medical gaslighting is when doctors or health professionals blame a patient's symptoms on psychological factors or completely deny the patient's illness entirely. And I thought I'd just start by, you know, reading off a couple facts so you kind of know what we're working with here and you're armed with information for this conversation. This practice is extremely commonplace for women and even more so for minorities, so women of a lower socioeconomic status, LGBTQ individuals, and women of color. Up until the 90s, women were not included in medical research, even though, you know, men and women are different on a cellular level. On average, when in emergency medicine, women who went to the ER with severe stomach pain were, on average, waiting 33% longer than men were with the same symptoms. And women are more likely to be misdiagnosed and twice as likely to be given a mental health diagnosis in response to their symptoms. And I'll just finish off my introduction with a quote I found when researching this topic, which was that the essence of dehumanization is the denial of another person's reality, which I think perfectly encompasses this topic.
Wow. That made me think about so many things. I think there's this notion, partly because, you know, women are the child bearers and we have this tolerance to, you know, be able to bear this physical weight and this physical pain, mm-hmm. that that when we're complaining of pain or, you know, when we're having pain, it's not, the debate of the seriousness kind of gets muddied, mm-hmm. in the water, right? Because it's you don't know how to quite judge that. It's like, well, but, you know, mm-hmm. women have babies and mm-hmm. that's like the most painful thing ever. It you'll be, you know, just breathe through it or whatever.
Yeah, well, I also think, you know, it roots back to the idea of female hysteria, how that was actually a diagnosis in the, I don't know when it stopped, but definitely in the 20th century. The word hysteria actually, in this context, roots from the Greek word for uterus. There is a certain idea that women are dramatic, and I think that plays into this issue. You know, when a man says his pain is at a 10, I think it's taken a little bit more seriously than when a woman says her pain is at a 10. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of personal experience with this sort of topic, so I've seen it firsthand. But honestly, when I was researching this, the facts that sort of backed up my experience are quite shocking and quite jarring to read.
Even the fact that, you know, some of the statistics that you gave in the preamble are quite shocking. You know, that women wait 33% longer than men to be looked at in the emergency ward, and you know, that they're so much more likely to be diagnosed with something. I don't want to say something other than maybe what their presenting symptoms are, because that's hard to suss out. But, you know, that mental health, the mental health diagnosis is not that far away. And closer for women than it is for men, you know, in the medical profession, it still shocks me.
Yeah, I think the problem is like a lot of symptoms people come in with are quite general. So, you know, if somebody's coming in with, you know, fatigue, muscle pain, back pain, like that can be a thousand different things. And it's so easy to chalk it down to stress and, you know, go through the easy avenue of diagnosis rather than taking a complaint seriously and like going deeper into it. And I think that's just a struggle for women.
And symptomatic, I think, of the profession, the medical profession in general, right, where they don't tend to treat in a holistic manner, right? They're looking at symptoms as the particular, you know, and they're not taking into consideration, well, you know, how stressful is your life? How are your relationships? Are you happy? Are you getting enough sleep? Are you nourished? Are you living in poverty? Are you worried about whether or not you're going to have a roof over your head in the next month, you know? And how all of these things affect how our bodies function and work, right? And that on a cellular level, biology is so complicated. and it's easy to just want to identify that one thing and then give you a pill. You know, and not treat you as a whole as a whole person.
Well, I'll share a little like personal anecdote, the experience I've had with this. You know, a couple of years back, I was on a wait list for a cardiologist for over a year and a half. Right, I'd seen a doctor, I needed to see a specialist, and it was a long wait list. I waited patiently. And I remember the first appointment I finally got with this cardiologist. It was over the phone. He had no physiological information to go off. He had on record a heart monitor that showed abnormalities, right? And, you know, he phoned me up. I talked about the issue for about 5 minutes, and very quickly the conversation moved to, and how's your stress level? Are you, like, it moved very quickly to a mental health conversation, and it really infuriated me because I thought, you know, I could expect this of a family doctor where, you know, I can book another appointment again, but I've waited a year and a half for this appointment, you know, dealing with heart issues this entire time because I couldn't see you, and you're going to turn this into a mental health conversation. Like, it made me really angry, and I had to really, really, really push for him to even do the further test, a very basic cardiac stress test in his office. It just was, like, shocking to me. I find it especially difficult when, you know, with specialists, because, you know, especially in Canada, you wait so long to see these people, you're suffering the entire time. And then to be told, you know, are you getting enough sleep? How's your stress? Do you have any mental health issues? It's just so invalidating, and like, it makes you feel crazy. Like, you start questioning yourself, well, is it anxiety? Is it this? It's, it like really, like, yeah, it's, it's a really dehumanizing experience.
Hmm. I appreciate you sharing that. It makes me think about how that task of self-advocacy,
mm-hmm.
you know, again, falls, the weight of that falls perhaps more heavily on women
mm-hmm.
than it does for men, because of these issues that we're talking about, right? And so it becomes kind of a, like the challenge is double,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we're up against someone questioning what we're presenting in the first place
mm-hmm.
and not being believed. And then we have to like step into that even more
mm-hmm.
and, you know, demand action and find our voice and mm-hmm. find what that voice is going to be.
Well, I think it like goes back to one of the topics we were talking about last week, which was agreeability. Like there's this pressure to, you know, be agreeable and not talk back and not question someone who's had years of medical experience. And I think also something that I struggled with is like I didn't want to push back too hard and appear too I think if you react, like the double-edged sword for me was if I reacted to what was going on, it makes me look even more of the unstable person that I was being painted to be. And it makes them question your the validity of what you're saying even more. So it's like you have to play this game of like being agreeable, but advocating for yourself and like having to convince a doctor that your symptoms aren't made up or completely psychological.
Yeah. And then we wonder why some people don't even bother going to the clinic, mm-hmm. right? I know that there was a big report, because one of the things that you mentioned in the preamble was that this disproportionately affects people who are living on the margins or, you mm-hmm. know, living on the fringes, and their health outcomes, A, because they're not part of any kind of studies, mm-hmm. right? So it's everything is judged against whether you match the single white male mm-hmm. phenomenon. Those are different. And there was a study that came out just last year. I think it's called The Color of Race. We talked about it here on Intravenous quite a bit, but they went into detail about, you know, what are those things that prevent you from being able to access proper medical care.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of it was language,
mm-hmm.
But a lot of it was that, you know, people are just not believed in terms of what they're showing up and presenting. And if they're not able to communicate what their experience is, then they'll just stay home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's, yeah, an uphill battle, and eventually it's like, is this worth even fighting if I'm just going to be maybe humiliated is the wrong word, but just like dehumanized in the process. Like I think it gets to a point where you're just like, I don't know if the income is different if I go or not go, so what's the point of going? Yeah, I'll share one other story I thought was interesting. I listened to a girl talk about how, you know, I can't say this is totally to do with gender, but I did think it was interesting and maybe speaks to this, is I saw a girl talking about how she was at university and she started getting extremely bad pain in her head, and then she started not being able to move her neck. And she went to her campus doctor. They said, I think you have meningitis. You need to go to the ER. Extremely serious. Can kill you. She went to the ER. She presented with the same symptoms. I can't move my neck. I'm having the worst head pain I've ever had in my life. And they told her she had a migraine. And so they said she was fine. They gave her some pain meds and they sent her home. When she went home, she completely collapsed, had to be taken. She was taken to another hospital and they told her, you absolutely have meningitis. I don't know how they could have missed this. And they told her if it had been any later, she probably would have died. At the time, her parents were being told they don't know if she's going to make it through the night. Like, super, super serious. And obviously, I can't say this is to do with gender completely, but I do think that there's a sort of issue where I'm trying to figure out how to word this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people want to go for the least serious diagnosis, and the highest probability is you have a headache. That's what most patients have when they have head pain. And I think that's a disservice to patients, because I think it's just a lack of validity. And I'm telling you, I know what a headache is, and this is not normal. Like, I just feel like patients struggle to advocate for themselves because they feel like there's a unfair power dynamic when you're dealing with someone who's been to medical school for 10 years, but you know what you're feeling. And it's just, again, an uphill battle that, like, it's very, very hard to advocate for and can result in life or death, you know, consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And especially when the medical team, there's a lot of male doctors mm-hmm. still out there and residences, and certainly specialists. Mm-hmm. So, you know, already within that power dynamic of, you know, being a woman trying to advocate for mm-hmm. yourself within that hierarchy of, you know, gender roles, that becomes really, really tricky. And, you know, it occurs to me too that most times it's also the mom mm-hmm. who's advocating for the health of their kids mm-hmm. too, you know, and for whatever those needs are. And, you know, if women aren't listened to, kids' concerns and how children can express themselves and you know, identify what is actually going on in mm-hmm. their bodies can really become a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, you know, women as primary caregivers in a lot of households, mm-hmm. like, I think a lot of parents are seen as being, like, are not listened to when they're bringing their child sick, because they're seen as being, you know, overprotective and, again, like, hysterical when they're, like, watching out for their kid's health. So I think the effect is not just on women, but on an entire family unit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And health is such a determinant in terms of, like, when health is at stake, mm-hmm. it affects and ripples out into so many other aspects of your life, right? It's such a it's such a stability post, I guess, is I can't think of exactly the word, but, you know, there's a lot that revolves around, you know, whether or not we feel like we have health or we have access to health.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a country like Canada where, you know, we're supposed to, quote unquote, supposed to have, you know, this universal mm-hmm. health care that, you know, access for everyone, yeah, not necessarily true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. Or in the ways that we're led to believe that we will be served by it.
Mm-hmm. I don't have too much to add to that thought, but I totally agree with you.
Yeah. It's interesting that, another thing that I was looking at or reading this morning was or is a report. I don't know if it's so much a report, but it's these seven injustices that need to change in order to shift how things are in the world and create a lot more gender equality now. And one of those things, it's actually number four on the list, is access to healthcare. And poor access to healthcare is so prevalent. The article or the site here talks specifically about access to healthcare and how that relates to preventable complications related to pregnancy and childbirth, mm-hmm. Because that's the sort of most I guess it's probably the medical process or the procedure that the majority of women across the globe mm-hmm. would engage with. And each day, almost 1,000 women die from preventable complications related to pregnancy and childbirth. And they say that the chronic absence of healthcare combined with the ongoing and unnecessary loss of so many women result in like unquantifiable massive impacts on families mm-hmm. and communities, mm-hmm. right? When the women die in childbirth, for instance, or if the children of sick mothers themselves have to access health care, they can't, and what does that look like? Older children have to drop out of school to look after mm-hmm. older siblings and sometimes their parents. Even here in this country, how we understand, what it is to be ailing or, what it means to be sick and what we're granted, mm-hmm. like if we're lucky and have a plan with our workplace, mm-hmm. maybe we get 8 sick days a year, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, if we have to take more time off, then hopefully we're rich. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And if we're, if we have a family that's dependent upon us as, part of the team.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple points related to childbirth I wanted to talk about. It's a couple weird things. So, a lot of women go through C-sections, right? That is a very extreme abdominal surgery. That's what it is. It's not a walk in the park. It's not a cut and then a stitch up. It is a really...
It's cutting through muscles.
It's a big surgery, yeah, right? Big. And it's one of the only... It is, I think, the only abdominal surgery where the instructions right after are not to be on bed rest for weeks and weeks. And that is because, you have a child that's coming out of you. But, in a lot of cases, if there are two parents in the picture, there's somebody else who can be looking after the child when a mother is in recovery from surgery. And I just think it's interesting that, like, why is the advice any different? It's very odd.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I don't think you're allowed to lift anything more than 10 pounds, and mm-hmm. a lot of C-section babies are 10-pound plus
yeah.
babies. And so technically you're not even allowed to lift your, or you shouldn't lift up your own baby. Mm-hmm. It's it's a very hard thing on the body for sure.
Yeah. I wanted to add one more thing about the topic in general, not so much on childbirth. Somebody
yeah.
sort of gave me this advice the other day, and I thought it was really, really helpful. If you're, you know, with a healthcare professional and you're in a situation where you're trying to convince somebody to take your condition seriously, or, you know, get tests to have further inquiries about what's going on. If your medical professional is refusing to do this, one thing that you can do that is helpful is to say, can you write down, put in writing on my file that you refused me this test? And what that does is, if you go to another professional and it is something more serious and that doctor refused to test you, in some cases it is malpractice, but more generally there's a lot more risk on the doctor if they refuse to test you, and that's in writing, that's written down, and you ended up actually having something. So something you can, a tool you can use to, you know, push for tests instead of just, like, you know, begging, is to flip it around and make sure that that's in writing. And that is definitely shown to, you know, help people in that situation. I don't know if that makes sense, but maybe not worded correctly, but the general point of what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. And yeah, oftentimes not something that we think about, right, is our own, you know, what our own medical records look like, mm-hmm. and how we can sort of have, you know, even though we might not feel in control of what's happening in the office, we can request that certain things are added to our mm-hmm. medical records, so that there's a paper trail sort mm-hmm. of the things that we've tried and attempted and demanded for and mm-hmm. been roadblocked about or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, no, that's great advice. Just a couple minutes in the show, so definitely want to wrap up. Any final thoughts? I mean, the piece of advice was great.
Yeah, I don't think so. I just think, you know, keep advocating for yourself. You don't need to be agreeable. You're not crazy. Just remember, a lot of this bias doctors have is subconscious. And you can push. A lot of this is out of your hands, but advocate for yourself, I guess. And yeah, I mean, I wish everyone good health.
Yeah. I think too, in terms of the medical stuff, you know, in recent years, when women are having pap tests and, you know, things where, you know, there's hands on your body, and mm-hmm. You can have someone in the room with you mm-hmm. now. You can request to have a nurse in the room with you. And I think that you can always request to have someone in the room yeah. with you to, you know, listen on your behalf mm-hmm. and, you know, just make sure that you're getting the kind of care that you need. And whether that's a friend or whether that's another practitioner, mm-hmm. I think that's also good. So thanks for listening. That's been today's show. Thanks for coming and bringing medical gaslighting to our attention. And of course, stay tuned to Democracy Now! It's coming up right away. See you in 2 weeks. Next week is the STEM podcast here on Intravenous.
Bye. Thank you.